Hi, everybody. This is Coach Porrick from the Humble Coach Podcast. Hope you're all doing well today. And thanks again for joining me on the show. So, a couple of things. First off, we are up on episode number 46. I most recently did the Sub 30 series for the first part of that, or the first episode of that. We will be returning back to that again very, very soon. But we're back to a more regular episode now, one of the longer ones we've done in a while. This one is in total an hour and a half. So we will be broken into two different parts of 45 minutes and about 42 minutes or so. But in today's episode, I had the huge pleasure of speaking to one of the excellent coaching educators, as far as I'm concerned, in the country, if not in the world at the moment. His name is Paul Kilgannon. Thankfully, he is a local Galway man, so I got a chance to sit down and have a good long chat with him over a cup of tea and of coffee in the morning. And it was a real education for me. Paul has most recently written a fantastic book called Coaching Children in Sport, the Carver Framework. And it is a framework that he's developed over the last number of years, which has been a huge, huge help to a huge amount of coaches. And I've no doubt it will be a fantastic help to coaches of all both sports and activities over the next number of years. He's had huge praise from high-level coaches such as Paddy Butler and Vern Gambetta, to name but a few. And I have no doubt you guys are going to really, really enjoy the show. Thanks a million again for joining me, folks, and have a good one.
All right, folks, so this is Coach Porrick. Hope you're doing well. This is the Humble Coach Podcast, and we're up on episode number 46. I'm joined today by an interesting man. His name is Paul Kilgannon. Paul, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Pete. I'm really happy to be here, man. Really happy.
So, folks, a lot of you will know of Paul's work in developing the Carver Framework for coaching children in sport. He's wrote a brilliant book. He's been kind of on the scene for a little while now. But he has a huge, huge amount of knowledge of both coaching children and adults. And how to really build an amazing framework and an environment for learning and for progress. Paul, could you give us a little bit of background about how you got into coaching a little bit, and how you kind of came up with the idea for the Carver Framework, if you could?
Yeah, Pete, for sure. I suppose the real grounding for me in coaching was really a kind of a love for my club and my hurling club, Cairnmore. When I was young, I fell in love with Cairnmore Hurling Club and the way they played the game. The team at the time, it was 92, 93, 94, 95. They got to a lot of county finals and they lost them, unfortunately. But that was, they were enjoyable days. So I really fell in love with the game of hurling and the club in particular. So I was just kind of really wanted to contribute to that thereafter. And I played, all the way up. But I probably fell into coaching maybe at 17, which probably, diluted my playing a lot, really. But, I started coaching, I think, at 17. And I think within a year or two of starting, there was a community games team where Cairnmore and Thurlough Moore came together under an umbrella of Clare Galway Lacca for the community games. And for 3 years, they went to the final in Mosmey for 3 years in a row. And they won it twice. There was a lot of kind of fellas that went on to be household names on them teams. Mm. But I think sure straight away I knew I was brilliant at coaching. And I knew I had all the answers. Yeah. And that's a bit of a joke there for anyone who doesn't get it. So listen, that gave me, I suppose, a little boost as regards, wow, I'm really into this. Maybe I'm okay at it. And maybe even more so, people must think I'm good at this. Mm. Whereas I suppose the harsh facts of it was, winning and maybe being a good coach, maybe they're correlated, but maybe they're not as connected as we like to think. So I would definitely say back then I was probably a really good, okay trainer, but I wasn't a coach. And we might look at that in a while. Yeah. And then I went on and I was in the club and, probably at 26, I started coaching the Cairnmore senior hurling team. And that was an obsession. So that was a genuine obsession for 3 years. We hadn't been going so well, and we we put it on the line really. We went after every game we could. Probably our standards were poor, so for a while before that. So I followed that dream there, and that was the only job I ever really wanted in sport was Caermore Seniors, and hopefully someday I'll have it again. But for that 3 years, really, eat, sleep, drink, obsession. After that, I was really burnt out. Really, really took an awful lot out of me, because it was such a personal thing. Then I probably went back to youth kids again, and I suppose when I went back down to kids, I think I went back at 7 or 8 or anything, and I looked around, and fellas that probably I looked at playing when I was young, when I was young, they were now coaching, and maybe it was a completely different game to what, so I had a skill set, so I started helping out there, and I suppose I was possibly a little shocked at how, how, for
Limited.
the opportunities for improvement, how maybe, it was so hard for people coming from any walk of life to coach kids, children, and it was a specialist area, and even coaching adults, specialist area. So stayed there, and then I suppose opportunities, people would, I maybe seen the way I did things, and maybe people started asking me to do coach education and that kind of thing. So started coach education for a few clubs around and bits and pieces. But I suppose as regards teaching was one thing, but the learning of the coaches was another. And I think I hit a block wall with it. Like I was giving coaching workshops. I don't think I was helping people because what I was trying to explain was a little bit different to what they wanted to learn. They wanted the next drill, or they wanted, the magic bullet. And I was there. I don't see it as this. Now I'm teacher, so that was give me a pedagogical background in what we're doing. So yeah, I said, listen, gonna have to write a book on this, because you're not getting it. Then started writing a book. Then went back, actually started coaching football team Claregalla, which would be the local football team, even though I didn't really have a background in football. I played a bit, so started coaching the Claregalla. They were intermediates. Started coaching them, and again, I suppose. In the meantime, I'd coach another club, Hurling Senior, but then the obsession started again, and spent 3 years there, and really worked hard and learned a lot, and with some good days there, enjoyed it, some bad days, a lot of struggle, learned an awful lot, and at the same time I was chairman of the Caermore Hurling Club at the same time, which was a bit crazy. And trying to build, I suppose, dealing with the end product of maybe average coaching and average coaching structures, and trying to build a framework for the club to get better at coaching and everything. So had that mix, and then at the same time was trying to write the book, and there were 4 years of a lot of torture, which was okay, because a phrase I use is the struggle is the pathway. Like it's. So would have basically got finished Claregalla there last year, and now I'm well. Last year I was with Caermore under 14s as well, and I'm with Caermore under 14s. We've two teams this year, A and B, and that's where I am at now. And I probably see that as, for now, and it was that sweet spot, that age as my home. And at the same, like I have coached 6 to 46 really, and I've taught infants, for 4 years. So I have a broad
Awareness,
appreciation of the human condition.
it's a good way of putting it, exactly.
Yeah, that's it.
But that's so that's a fairly serious mixed bag of experience. And I think one of the biggest parts about that is, like you mentioned there, that you have a good awareness of all the entire human condition. But like you mentioned, that kind of under 14s, that adolescent type of an age group is pretty much the sweet spot at the minute. And is there a particular reason you like that sweet spot? Is it having looked at the younger age groups when there's basically just building on the actual basic motor skills, etc. But then also like that, there's a kind of the 16, 18s, which might be a little bit just north of, okay, if it hasn't been developed there, we're kind of caught. Is that one of the reasons that you like that kind of a group?
Listen, I think if we developmentally, if we look at a 12, 13, whatever maturation physically, they're really ready to train physically. A lot of them, So that's really interesting. It's really interesting for me. And at the minute, we're doing a lot of great stuff with buddy of mine, Neil O'Toole. My guys are doing, I don't know what you want to call it. You can call it athletic development. You can call it strength and conditioning, whatever. Whatever
the
doesn't
wording,
get me
exactly.
shot, basically, call it that. So there's a great opportunity there. And what I find with them is, you know, there is a void there at that age. Is they'll either go one or two ways. And the phrase we use with our lads is aggressive to learn. And we've created a kind of an environment where they're hugely aggressive to learn. And we're just using, you know, we're providing them with information and they're soaking it up and they're loving it around nutrition, around maybe sports psychology, bits and pieces about that, around analyzing your own performance, around, you know, goal setting, simple stuff, and they are primed. I think it's just the age. Can it be done at 16, 17, 18? Obviously, but is the right time at this age? I would believe so. And then what we're getting now with our lads is we've a mix of maybe 13, 14s, and then we've 12s, and then we're creating that kind of a culture of, you know, of learning from your peers or the lad a bit above you. And I find that fascinating. And I believe too in the first exposure, like I think the first exposure is so important, like, because they might learn it the first time around, but if they hear it again at 16, 18, whatever, well then they might be really ready. So I use that concept in school a lot, where I talk to the kids. I'm a fourth class teacher. I talk to them a lot about stuff that's perhaps beyond them. But I believe that if we expose them to that early, that they might forget about it, but next 3-4 years later they might read or hear something and go, you know, I remember that clown talking about that before. And now I'm interested in it. So that's part of the thing. That's 14 is lovely for me at the minute.
Nice. I think that's really interesting. Now we'll move on a little bit. And the concept, like you mentioned it's Mobbit earlier on, the concept of the trainer versus the coach. And I think we all like to, and I'm no different than yourself, I would have started coaching, I suppose, at kind of 16, 17. I would have had a bit of a different vibe though, I suppose. My background was in boxing, in amateur boxing, and my parents and one of my brothers and some of my family would have got involved with the local club in Mayo at whatever, 8 or 9, kind of odd. And I just remember, I was, I think it was about 16 maybe, and I was kind of finishing up my own athletic career, in so to speak, or my competitive career. And a load of the season start back in September, and we didn't have enough coaches, and it was just manic. And I suppose I'd shown an interest in coaching. I'd always been kind of helping the pads and whatever it was. And my dad and one of the other coaches was like, right, Sam. So he was dealing with the other kind of serious characters, like the 14s, 15s, and so on. And there was the kind of 8 to 11 to 10, 11-year-olds. There's about 20, 25 of them. And the parents are kind of hanging around in the whole lot. And he's like, right, you can take them. So, and I have to take these bunch of kids for half an hour. And I'm like, Jesus. So you kind of get stuck into it. But as I've developed over the years, the concept of trainer versus coach, especially in a team setting, having worked with individual teams and stuff like that, it can be such a huge gap mentally. But could you speak a little bit about your concept of the trainer versus the coach?
So I think that's where I start the book in chapter one. What is coaching? And the way I try to explain it is the difference between a trainer and a coach. And I think we all start off on the journey to being a coach by being a trainer first, or many of us, if you're like me, anyways. So for me, the trainer looks just at a player and at the game and how they can get all the information that's in their head and pour it or force it into the player, and maybe become, if it works, be kind of, I suppose, delusional. And if it doesn't, then be whatever the option of that is.
Be annoyed.
So, so I think a trainer is very much, what are my drills? Can we go faster? You know, and then if it doesn't work, well, they weren't listening to me. You know, I told them that, you know, the famous, geez, I told them that before the game. So that is the trainer. And then I think the coach is just a change of perspective. And I think that they, and again, it's without being sugarcoating and without being soft, because coaching isn't all about, you know, hand around and, you know, a bit of the you know, the modernization of this. Coaching is more creating a learning environment where people want to contribute, and how we can understand the human experience within this environment. and how we can get the best out of people and how we can solve problems. So problem solution is a quick motto I would use. What's the problem? What's the solution? They're not interested. Can we get something that's going to interest them? They're not learning. Can we use a reflective tool to help them learn? They're not being, you know, they're not being honest. Well, can we get some sort of a mechanism that's going to raise their awareness, basically?
Yeah.
So for me, a coach is high levels of self-awareness of what it feels like to be coached by them, how they treat the weakest, what the players might think of them, why they coach. So self-awareness, the holistic nature of coaching, and the qualities that really make a really good player, not the physical, technical, but also the social and the mindset and all that. So they have a broader appreciation, or it's what I talk about in the book, a broader scope or a set of lenses. And that to me is coaching. But I'm not watering it down to it's all about we never do this or we never do that. You know, sometimes we bark because sometimes, you know, bad medicine is good medicine. So it's, I think sometimes we try and, you know, try and be perfect. And, you know, it ain't perfect. But if you go on a coaching journey and try and, what I would use the phrase, build a coaching world, a broad appreciation of human environment and human experience is a good place to start. And I think the coach really wants to learn as they go along. There's a hunger. We use the phrase aggressive to learn. There's a hunger to learn and to figure out the problems, where maybe a trainer just wants to, you know, wants it all to be a lot easier than what it actually is, you know. And I wish it was easier too.
Yeah, I think, well, that's, it's quite interesting, that description, because I would have been guilty, and no doubt lots of other people would have been guilty of that, needing that next drill and kind of going, okay, I need to, this should be tidier, because you look at something else and you're like, these guys are very organized on their drills and they're very seamless enough kind of a session and the whole lot. And kind of like, why can't, I'm just trying. And like you mentioned there, it becomes, for me anyways, it comes back to that, you're not going to always have, you may not always have your own specific core values at the front of your head straight away in every single session, but you will catch yourself on quite quickly and go, okay, look, there's a reason this is not working.
And I just put it there. I think the core values have to be at the forefront of everything.
All the time.
And I believe that, and my session plan will always have the core values written on it.
Yeah.
I try to use catchphrases, so one of them would be, the most important thing is we keep the most important thing the most important thing. And if they're your core values, they need to be try to be in everything. And if they're not there on days, which they're not, you know, you need to be aware that they weren't there today, and there needs to be that humility that we learn. So the core values, it's up to you to value whatever you value, but I think I think it's interesting in that, you know, you're talking about linearity and training sessions are training like a bang, bang, bang.
Yeah.
And I'll create this really brilliant drills and it'll be a great session and they'll go from this to that and it'll be, you know, seamless. And that's training, really. It's not learning.
Yeah.
And it's not, there's no mistakes and there's no real experiential learning environment. But for coaching and an improvement in coaching, I do believe in a bit of a process plan, do review, that small bit of linearity to coaching, even though, because I think you have to have a reference back to how we're learning and how am I getting better or am I getting worse. And I know I deal with some coaches, I suppose you could call it whatever, I help them, adult coaches, and, you know, we talk about reflection and they'll say, oh, yeah, I do that. Yeah, I do that. And I'm there, do you really? You know, do you really, like, or are you just driving home thinking a bit about, geez, that wasn't great? And, well, what are you doing about it, like, and how are you driving accountability within your own coaching world? So in the book I have a kind of a reflection tool where you mark your sessions out of 110 10 out of 10 in different areas, and the coaching is like the plan, do, review model, and then like getting better at that cycle. So maybe I cut across you there, but
it's a really good segue actually now into the next one. And I think, like, you are right, I think it can be a challenge though from coaches. Now I have no doubt in I think it depends on the sport. Now mind, I do appreciate that it's it can be a tough one when you're working with different age groups, and I think depending on the experience that you might have as a coach, the interest level or the awareness, like you mentioned, of the need for all these self-reflective tools and the they might look around, a simple example might be, they might look at a team that they have, a particular coach, and they realize, oh, geez, you know what, I don't know if I have an awful, not that I don't have an awful lot of skillful players, but like, we've been getting hockey there recently. We probably need to push a little bit more. Like the typical one, and I think you mentioned in the book, is like, they're not fit enough. And you're like, this is this lunacy. Like, because all you might need is a handful of players a little bit more savvy with the ball. And immediately you look way flipping fitter, like, you know. But I think one of the challenges can be, like you mentioned, bringing that real self-awareness and patience to yourself and going, okay, no, I need to start being the real catalyst to the learning environment that you'd like to build. And that's what I'd like to kind of see what your thoughts on there about how you can build a very positive learning environment within a team setting or a particular group or whatever it is. But is there that balance between both the, I suppose, the soft skills and the hard skills, or have you any other kind of thoughts on how to build
so
it?
I think all too often, you know, we just run out in the pitch and start, you know, and day one, oh, geez, that was a great session, you know, and day two, day three, geez, I don't know. So I think I use the phrase building a coaching world, but building a learning environment. So clarity and consistency are really important in any place where we want learning or, you know, logic.
Yeah.
And for me, the place we always must start is sitting down. We almost must start with a common understanding of what this might look like. And what success might be for us, what's acceptable, unacceptable, what's exceptional. And for me, with a team that's developmentally ready, which might be 12, might be even 10 if they're whatever, I don't know where, it might be 14.
Yeah.
It looks like a team charter, which basically is a little document where you pull together maybe a phrase, which we would do. And I said in the book last year, my lads under 13 last year was winning and losing is nothing but to fight is everything. That was our motto for the year. This year it is, we have to work in order to be hard. So that's our overriding guide. And then we break it down into simple things like, what does this look like? You know, so for us this year, it looks like everyone practices to get better. We don't just practice to get better at home. We're tight off the pitch, blah, blah, blah. Eight or six things, what it looks like. And then it looks like a clarity of what we expect from management, and what's unacceptable from management. And real interesting thing that I always find, because I always forget it, is the job of management is help them get better. You know, and one thing you'll always get back is, tell me how I can get better. So sometimes we just keep challenging them, but we don't assist. So that's part of the charter. And then how we're going to drive accountability is, it needs to be another part. And then what success will look like. They'll be all little subheadings, you know, and it's amazing what they come back with, you know, to gain respect of our opponents is success. Right, so that gives us clarity. And then, you know, what we want the management to say about us at the end of the year. So that gives us clarity. So then we have clarity. Many times I've said the word. But then we're just trying to live that world, you know. So we create a vision for what we want this team to be, and then we try to deliver it, and we review it, and we don't run away from it. And everyone gets a little copy, and it's laminated, and they all get it, and it's an opt-in, because if you don't want in, that's cool, no biggie. I say, it's always an opt-in. We don't force anything on anyone, because if we do, it's diluted. Like, you know, there's an efficacy thing. It doesn't matter whether it's right or wrong. It's whether they think it's right or wrong. So so I would like to think we've provided them with the opportunity to create their world, what they want to be part of. And then that gives us a kind of a framework to say, well, we're not living this. Or it was very interesting yesterday with a little, we're doing a 3-day thing for, we're on midterm or whatever. So I take them for 2 hours a day for 3 days, and I was saying to our lads, I said, and perhaps quite rashly, and I'm still not sure whether I was right when I said it, I said, if you're not practicing at home every day to get better, you have no place in this team. And I turned to one of the players and I said, what do you think of that? And he goes, well, that is the truth. One of my players said, and I thought, he's 13, like, he's not 14 to July. And I thought, so you know, there's a bit of clarity there. So that thing, I think when you get clarity, people are a vision, people are hardwired to contribute to that, to follow that mentality. So that learning environment, and we use the phrase because I think we've seen it on a wall last year. We were somewhere as a team, and was Michael Jordan, aggressive to learn. So we used him, that, are we aggressive to learn? And then we have a few other tools that drive the learning. So the culture or the environment is one of we're trying to get better, and it's becoming better. It's not we are better. It's how can we get better at this? So where it breaks down is if we don't have clarity at the start, and that's where we become reactionary, and that's really all over the place. But that's about where I thought you asked me the question.
Yeah,
that's
no,
where
I think that's, no, that's bang on. Like
and it's it might sound perfect, but it's far from perfect. And there are plenty of you know, I think there's plenty
challenges
of challenges along the way. Even though at the minute I'm with a group that are, you know, as we say, aggressive to learn, and it's a brilliant spot for us. It's a brilliant, you know, it's a story I always tell, because I do a lot of coach education, and there's one particular player, obviously I won't name, he's a young lad on our team, but he drives accountability pretty hard or pretty direct. And last year it was part of the cool camps, but I did an hour a day with our lads during the cool camp, and I'd always have a stopwatch. I believe you don't train with a phone, always stopwatch, but for that day I just didn't have the stopwatch, so I was using the phone, and I don't know, whatever was happening, he said, "Paul, get off the phone." And I went, wow, brilliant, brilliant, aggressive to learn, driving accountability. And another night we're in the gym, and I don't really have anything to do with the gym sessions, because we have a fella that helps us there, a specialist, and my hands are in my pockets. He said, "Take your hands out of your pockets." And normally people would find that threatening or whatever, challenging. Yeah. I just think it's fantastic.
Yeah,
he's challenging me to be the best I can be within his environment, because he wants to get brilliant. And then I challenge him, and we'll work from that point of clarity and I suppose you can call it equality, but you can call it whatever you want to call it. It's a mutual respect, and it's a very straight environment. And the moments in my coaching were wow moments. And I say, I tell that to a lot of coaches, and they go, "Oh, Jesus, no."
Yeah.
You know, but we don't sweat that.
Well, I see, like I wouldn't be, I'd like to think that I would not be upset or anything like that, annoyed by that. But I think you're dead right. If you have, when you've built a strong enough framework, and you have, like, even I could see the potential for different groups and different teams. Like, if you build that level of clarity to begin with, the amount of buy-in you could get from players is unbelievable. Like, you could, like, irrelevant of what age group, you'd have, they'll absolutely go through walls for you. Like, but it's more than that. Like you mentioned, that there's that eagerness to learn, but also a very quick, and I think it's very, very difficult to develop that, and it can be a maturity issue, that someone like that who might be 13 will have a different mentality than someone who's 16, who may have gone through the same kind of framework, but they just haven't built that maturity, and they haven't bought in as much to it.
I think there's a phrase there that they use in the Barcelona way, and it's called, there's a new book there, Damien, I can't really remember his name, but it's called, I'm reading it at the minute, and it was Barcelona Way. He talks about cultural architects, and I think we can develop leadership qualities, but I think our real leaders are probably born.
Yeah.
And if you don't have a few of them, it's going to be tough.
Yeah.
So the model I espouse there for the last 20 minutes is, in theory, it sounds really good.
Yeah.
But I've been in team environments where it hasn't worked that so well. It's brought improvement, but it hasn't brought optimal performance. Why? There are many reasons. But, you know, if you have, you just can't, no matter what you're doing, if you have the lieutenants on the ground, and I suppose in the Barcelona way, they call it the cultural architects.
Yeah.
And it's a great phrase.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, if you don't have your boy that said, that's the truth, and you don't have that, you know, it can be hard. Can you foster that? You can by degrees.
Yes.
Some groups will be better. You know, you know.
But you need as some again, of those troops on the ground for you. Like,
absolutely. So, like, the analogy, but the book that is created around is the Carver framework.
Yeah.
So the analogy is, I saw the angel in the stone, and I carved until I set him free. Michelangelo. So coaching is really bringing out the best. So there is a bit of nature nurture.
Yeah.
You know, the best of one group will be different to the best of another group.
Exactly.
And the social norms will be different. And I suppose when you go in full circle to what you said to me about the 14s, sometimes with adults, collectively, culturally, the boat has possibly sailed.
Yeah.
And to try and change that can be really hard, because it's formed or it's adapted or, you know,
yeah,
it's so well learned. Whereas that's what I really find that. And to be honest, and I could be way wrong, I think that's where there's going to be a big shift in coaching to youth development, and I can see it,
Yeah.
you know, how we can not have them finished by 17, but definitely
No.
have them well built, and
Exactly,
that
yeah.
we are, you know, if you look at the model of a club paying 20 grand to a manager to manage a senior team who might be stuck together, if you put a fraction of that into your coach education, of your younger coaches and your developmental coaches, you know, I think I think it makes, you know,
Oh yeah, it's a huge
I think
difference.
there's a huge difference. Like, you know, I would, I don't know, am I able to coach adults? You know, some people can. I wonder, can I?
Yeah.
But I think the coaching of the child and the youth is possibly easier for me. Again, people are different, and that's just
Yeah,
me.
I think it's an interesting one. Just to take up on that point, actually, I think, and we mentioned a little bit earlier on, and it can be a difficult one, I think, with adults. In well, obviously, you've got quite driven people, depending, or you have very undriven people, and this might be their actual only kind of the only avenue for release from their normal job or normal day or whatever it is, their normal life, and it can be a difficult one on that. So then, their potential and interest in learning and reconfiguring their positioning or their quality of movement or whatever it is, all of these different bits and pieces can be quite difficult to bring on board, because they're like, look, I just want to come out and have a bit of crack and tip away on it. When it comes to the younger groups though, like that, I think if you, like that kind of age group, that kind of 10 to so on, like whenever you, even if you just make a small little adjustment in your language, the difference it can make is so huge. Like,
well, the thing with that age, and you know, I came across it yesterday when I was looking again, is like the dream is still red hot with that
yeah,
age. The
absolutely.
Dream, you know, maybe when we get to 20, the dream is,
we think about ourselves when we're 14, like,
yeah, you know, maybe the dream is a bit of town and a bit of this and a bit of,
exactly.
and a bit of career and a bit of everything.
Yeah.
And geez, maybe I might play for Galway or I might win an All Ireland or I might whatever. So the dream is probably diluted a bit. So, you know, if we're getting them when the dream is red hot, like, and we're providing that information, inspiration, balance, and that environment where people wanna are safe to really play with courage.
Yeah.
Well, that is, you know, that's a great
thing. That is the dream.
And then the thing about like coaching 14s is they're all there most of the time, you know, which is always a brilliant plus. Whereas adults, you know, there's a lot of barriers we need to overcome, and maybe they're not there. So, you know, that's what makes it lend itself a bit easier than the other challenges.
Yeah,
the other challenges are interesting, and I will be back in adult sport, and I enjoyed it, but the coaching, and I think we will see a shift coaching of career coaches at 14, career coaches at 16, fellas staying there, specialising, doing great work, you know, and an appreciation of the work they do there.
Do you think that there's a need for how do I say it now? A better awareness of the type of framework that should be built for younger age groups rather than adult types of team, so to speak. Does there need to be a different, I suppose, a Carver framework 2.0 kind of thing for the adults, or is it just more of a sister kind of a
to
framework?
To me, you know, principles are principles, you know, that's it.
Yeah.
And the same principles apply. So the methods might be different. So when I was writing my book, which I get a headache talking about because it was such a hard experience in my life.
Traumatized.
You know, I was coming at it from a teacher. I was coming at it from an under-14 coach. I was coming at it from a chairman. I was coming at it from an adult. And the same principles are the same principles.
Yeah.
The methods are different. But the principles of coaching are the same. It's human environment, human interaction, session design, clarity, and the law of consistency. And plan, do, review, and solve the problems as they come along. So it doesn't matter what you're coaching. And, you know, I know lots of people in lots of different teams that are using the same principles.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting. So what I tried and that's why I had to rewrite it 30 times. What I tried to do was I tried to write the simplest yet densest book that I could about how you could build a world and practice improvement. Now, I think you have to read the book, maybe. I'm reading myself all the time. Because
yeah, there's definitely going to be two or three reads at least.
Oh, well, geez, now, P, you must be very smart. No, I think, like, you know, I'm being facetious there. You know, I think the commitment to the process of how you're going to build this world, that's the first time I'll use that word today, sorry. So the commitment to that structure is a lifelong thing. And I know myself at the minute, right, I'm not using systematic reflection. So normally I do a reflective sheet at the end, and I mark myself out of 10 and 10 different things, and that's what I have in the book. I'm not doing it at the minute for whatever reason.
Yeah.
I actually don't have the new sheet changed up, and I'm struggling because of it. And what I'm finding in myself is I'm getting maybe a bit of post-session anxiousness or something, that if I use that tool, which I have to go home and get ready whenever now, it'll be washed. You know, and maybe it's lingering for a day or two because I'm not really reflecting and really ready to go again after my session. So I think no matter who you are, I came across a phrase. I'm very good at remembering phrases, little catchphrases. The mastery is in the process. And I think that's where it is in coaching. That plan, do, review, get better, solve the problem, move on. So it's about becoming a better coach. It's never that... I am one, or, you know, because the human environment and interaction is so dynamic that we can never have the answers. It's not like, as I say, it's not like 5 times, 10 times tables where there's an answer. It's Jesus, we need to figure this out. And if we don't have some sort of a structured approach to figuring out the problem, well, then number one, it's not going to be efficient because you're going to spend all your time thinking about
it,
which you might do, I know, but I don't know, it's a tool.
So we'll go in a little. We'll go, I suppose, a little bit of another direction just now. And I know this would be quite a strong kind of a buzzword. The constraints led approach, which is great crack, like. and Twitter, I think, is money for this. And I kind of joke about it there, but it's a huge, huge area of progress that's I think is a good secret weapon for a lot of coaches if they use it right. Could you speak about your attitude
journey.
To it and your approach to it and what you kind of what you make of how valuable it might be for us as coaches?
So I suppose the first thing is I do not have a PhD in this, and I'm not an expert in it. I am many others phrase it as a generalist, so I have a general appreciation of it. And first of all, I must say that I believe how we coach is more important than what we coach. You know, so I believe that fundamentally. So nothing's ever going to change there. And I believe that most things work if we set them up for success. So even if we did, say, unopposed drills every day, but if everybody did them at 100% and it was really, really, really on the money, I think we'd get a lot of improvement. Automaticity or whatever we want to call that. I don't know. On the flip coin, if we designed unbelievable constraints-led approach to coaching and the environment wasn't right, I don't think we'd have any learning. So that's how I qualify it to start with. So then if I break it down into with problem solving. So what we learn to do, we learn by doing badly, is a principle. Walking and talking, talking and all that jazz. So then we need to give them massive opportunity to do it badly. And then if we look at, we'll say, the perception action coupling triangle of, you know, environment, task and individual, and appreciate that. And then if we look at, you know, I suppose you have Bernstein would say repetition without repetition. Well, you probably come somewhere to a middle ground where it says, okay, is this like the game? And even at that, sometimes seeing people think the games-based approach, there are differences, constraints, like game-based, game sense, it's an academic area. So sometimes we think it's game-based, but maybe it's not, because it's not representative. And I actually I'm off the phone this morning to he's a top end coach in a top end team, and we were talking about session design, and he did this, and I said, yeah, but is it representative? So is it look, feel, and act like the game? And he goes, that was the question I was asking myself. So I think sometimes when we go into session design, we might fool ourselves into thinking, well, wow, this is, they're doing so much, there's so much repetition in this, and there's so much everything. So if we went into a grid game where you have to pass four times to get a score, well, that's not representative practice design. And I have done that, and the smartest players on the pitcher says, Paul, this makes no sense. I should be shooting, and you're telling me to pass three times before we can shoot. So if we take all these things into it, if we have a clear vision of how the game should be played, okay? So for me, hurling is about progression. It's about winning your own ball, primary possession, and all that. So then, can we design sessions that really work that? And is everything, is there a why in everything? Why we're doing this? And does it lead into the bigger thing? And is it representative of the game we want to play? And then if we get to that point, and then on the right-hand side, we have the environment where we're all at 100%. Well, then we're really getting to a good place of why we're doing this. So if we want the challenge to be on the good players to be more extreme than what it would be in a game, because we want to get them the opportunity to train at a higher level, maybe go 2-on-1 for things. Okay? If we want them to get better at passing, maybe we give them more opportunities in a game to pass, like a floater player. Okay? If we need to build a scaffold in them for them to play richer, maybe we put in an adult. They play as the playmaker. So we're giving them something, we're making
Giving the
the
tools
behaviors
to work.
easier. And again, if we want to practice an overlap, can we create a game like consequential game where there's winning and losing, or we're counting and scoring, which I believe really is important, of an overlap and count and challenge. And then we go into, we'll say, if we go to a games based or the variables of a game based, if we want application at a really high level, which I believe is the mother of all, can we get these boys really at it? So if we don't ref it that well, or if there's a sideline that's, geez, we didn't call it a sideline there today, but we might tomorrow. Well, will we get application over time? No, because we're not asking specific questions. If we're not really reffing it that well, are they really going to apply themselves? Probably not. If when they're developmentally ready, which might be 10, might be 8, might be whatever age, if we don't keep scores, and if we don't say, right, we're going to play for 8 minutes, and there's going to be a winner and loser, well, then are they going to apply themselves? So all them variables come down into why I believe something very close to representative practice design, if that's to be constraints-led approach to coaching or ecological dynamics or whatever, which I'm not qualified enough to really, whatever. Well, that's my logic. Now, it's very, very interesting, because yesterday with my team, my under-14s, who I kind of had them 2 years, for the first time ever, we did unopposed drills. Because we're on an AstroTurf, and there's this thing I believe we have to commit. I want them to commit to attack the ball, which might mean they leave it behind them. Now, it's a lot easier for me to pull that out in isolation and get them running as fast as they can and then hit the ball at them. Because I'm taking away every other variable, and I'm just saying, go as fast as you can, and I want you to miss the ball. So the first time in 2 years, we did unopposed drills. Also in the session design, I believe, so why we should not, we should give them a reason to go home and practice. So why would I do anything in session that they can do themselves at home? So I want to provide, I say, connect it back to the game, connect the reason back. I want to provide that fairly sound logic that when we come in here, we come to play. Come to play. You need to practice at home to survive in this games based or whatever environment. And then I think that it provides a fair bit of logic and a fair bit of reference to why we do what we do the way we do it. And that is a very roundabout way of answering the question.
It's not a bad way. It's not a bad way. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff within that. Now, notwithstanding that I'm no expert either on the concept of constraint-led approach or skill acquisition and all this kind of this can be a whole other world of interesting stuff. But that's what the last couple of points that you actually made there for me is where the real crux of it's at. When you get somebody to, and I think it goes back to that kind of a fire, in general. Like that, once you have that bit of a fire in it, it's very quick skew of somebody who, girl or boy or man or woman or whoever it is, that has that, they still have that love of the game or a real interest in the game. Now, they may not necessarily be wedded to like the romantic view of it or whatever it is, but they can appreciate the game. They like playing it. Something about it, about the way that they do that, resonates extremely well with them. But then you have the other side who will just switch off, and it'll just become, I don't know, that game's just kind of wrecking my head a bit. Like, I can't be dealing with it. I just have to go to this. I have to do this. I have to do this. For me, there's two very different have to's. I have to do this for my mental health, or I have to do this because someone is telling me to do it. And when it comes to the practice at home, I'm no doubt similar to yourself. Like, I would have, along with my brother, spent hours upon hours upon hours in the front drive with barely a light on, playing football till 10 o'clock at night, and parents going bananas and the whole lot. And the amount of detail that we would have done, we would have craved, gone to a training session, picked up one or two bits, gone straight home and gone for it. Using those training sessions as fuel for the practice to come back and then actually survive in them. Like, I'm sure you're the same, but any of the sessions that I ever enjoyed the most were the ones where I was probably the most challenged on a consistent level. And I had to actually survive within them. But I just about survived. I'm like, oh, jeez, that was a tough
So
going, but it was nice, nice
that's a
challenging.
really interesting place. So even in reading in school, there's a miscue analysis which says, we need to be able to read 90% of the words on the page, or else it's beyond us. So that is an area I'm struggling with at the minute with my own lads, because we've some 14-year-olds who are really, really good, and some lads who are really, really weak. And if I use a phrase, I was giving a talk last night, and we were talking about, like, in education we use differentiation all the time. Like, the good boys do a little bit better, and the weaker boys or girls do a little bit easier. And that's one of the real sweet spots in coaching. And a bit of grading is important there. The appropriate challenge, because competence drives confidence, and then it drives contribution. And likewise, confidence drives competence. So I suppose that is, how can we design practices? But then I think, actually, sorry, go back to it. Then eradicating the fear of mistakes then is great.
That's exactly a
So,
huge
like
part.
in the vision section
Huge
of the
part.
book, I say a vision for the way the game is played. What is your vision for the way the game is played? And my answer is, the game is played with joy, and it's played with courage. Courage is the absence of fear. So they will keep going back to them things and trying them things if the environment suggests. And then the interesting thing about the practice at home, like, it's a brilliant example. They're being inspired. And as a coach, your job is to bring energize the group and to bring inspiration and logic to why we should practice. Well, why on God's green earth, if I'm going to go up to that green place every day and do these drills, would I bother practicing them at home? So
Fact.
I want to give, and it's interesting because in the last couple of years, I have started near every session really in hurling and with a variation of the rondo.